We'll begin our chapter on Hatha Yoga in just a moment, but I thought we might talk a bit about the early history of Hatha Yoga first. And this history commences in that area where India, Tibet, and China, in a sense, come together. We don't have an exact text that fixes when this arose. You're satisfied. Good. We shall recommence. Hatha Yoga, most likely in its earliest elements, arose at that place where India, Tibet, and China intersect. Probably in the early centuries of the Common Era. Some of the practices are very familiar to the alchemy that we know in Taoism, focusing on the technologies of the self that they had extrapolated, but also Indian Kriya practices from that time utilized the same inner circuits of the body as they are described. There's considerable overlap. In both cases, for instance, there is an interesting point regarding what we would call in Sanskrit the Kechari Mudra, where there's a contact between the tongue and the back of the upper palate, which helps us to bring flowing into us a region of divine consciousness. These exercises that we know bring the whole of the body into a suitable condition to practice the internal forceful technology that delivers one out of the merely human consciousness into an uplifted and enlarged consciousness, which can return upon the physical vehicle and not simply prolong its life, but the early aims of the Hatha Yogins were at actual physical immortality. These practices became known as Dao Yin or Qigong in the Chinese context later, and as Hatha Yoga in the Shaiva context, as Prulkhor in the context of the Tibetan Vajrayana. Now, all of this is coming not stated in text, but in oral tradition, specific individual practice, the transmission from the teacher to the disciple. And this is where we get an unusual enhancement of the role of the guru in the transmission of consciousness and power to the readied, endowed shishya. So this teaching comes from that area and moves through the Himalayas and through the foothills of the Himalayas and found fertile ground in Kashmir. And we have there an efflorescence of a number of different teachings all at one time. The Trika philosophy of the Shiva Sutras, etc., leading all the way up to Abhinavagupta and his wonderful, beautiful prose, which describes a Vedanta unknown to Shankara, but thrilling in its similarities to Sri Aurobindo's teaching in many respects. Subsequently, of course, Gorakshanath, the first human that we know, there was presumably a Matsyendranath who was his teacher, but Matsyendranath we have no historical record of. Of Goraksha, we do have record, and he brought into powerful synthesis the tantric practices, alchemy, and what we now call Hatha Yoga into a blend using the postures and the breathing practices of Hatha Yoga along with Rasayana in the alchemy. And then the known tantric practices, which by then had been emerging for 5 or 6 centuries. So this is a very complex web where you have Vedanta meeting Tantra, and the Tantra might be Shaivite in origination, or it could be centered on the Shakti, on the Mahadevi. But one thing is clear, that the first use of the term Hatha in connection with these practices is not in Shaivite tantric texts, it's rather in, I think, the 8th century text Vimalaprabha commentary on the Kala Chakra Tantra, which is Buddhist. It's a Buddhist tantric text. So wherever it originates, whether it was in a Hindu setting or in a Buddhist setting, these were practices that were effective, that changed one's actual consciousness and experience of life in the world, and had a profound impact on the body. So this was a technology, a psychotechnology that was coming along and got adapted to the terminology and the philosophy prevalent wherever it landed. But everybody wanted it. And it dealt with the body as it is. So we see in the 10th century something beginning to be articulated in what I guess you would call the Hindu tantras, Kubjika Mata, where 6 power centers, remember the chakra system, the 6 power centers became the inner architecture with the Kundalini at the base, forced to rise. She comes up through a central channel, the Sushumna, and rejoins Shiva above. So connecting matter to spirit was the first aim. As a practical basis, though, the Amrita Siddhi Tantra, which appears in the year we found it, or we didn't find it, James Mallinson found it in China, seems to have come into being. It's dated, I think, 2nd March 1160, which is a tantric Buddhist work. Doesn't necessarily refer to Hatha, but it teaches 3 bandhas, the Mahabandha, Mahamudra, Mahaveda, which involve bodily postures, breath control, teaches one how to find inside oneself the eternal energy of life force itself, prana, and to drive it upwards. The consciousness opens, and dripping down the central channel comes Amrita. So we move from the 10th to the 12th century. In the 13th century, we get the Goraksha Shataka, which is a Nath text based upon Goraksha. He himself did not write anything, so this is derived teaching, which then gets formulated and we have the whole knot lineage beginning to develop from there. Probably the most famous individual text in the lineage of Hatha Yoga, though, is the Hatha Pradipika, which comes into being in the 15th century. And here, Hatha Yoga begins to take the postures, the breathing practices, which are common to a number of traditions, and wants to willfully unite them with what remains of the Raja Yoga tradition. You've heard of Patanjali and his Yoga Sutras. Although Hatha Yoga has been practiced now for roughly 1,000 years in one way or the other, now it begins to come into a kind of philosophic marriage, aligning its teachings with the dualistic Sankhyan terminology that's at the root of Raja Yoga. But it goes a step beyond simply that and has to deal with the dominant philosophy of the time, which was Advaita, non-dualistic in approach. And so you see Swatmarama, who is the author, we suppose, of the Hatha Pradipika, attempting to forge a synthesis so that the emphasis on escape from the world in the Raja Yoga and denial of the world's existence in Advaita Vedanta gets somehow blended with this body-centric practice that begins this long route to liberation from where one sits, from one's own life force, from the control of the nature, the mastery of the form, the spirit within conquering all along the way. So this is the Hatha Pradipika. Of course, we've called it often Hatha Yoga Pradipika, but when we actually started unrolling the manuscripts, hundreds of them simply say Hatha Pradipika, light on the force. So there are other important texts that come along, Kichari Vidya, Shiva Samhita, which is a Shaiva non-dualistic text, very voluminous, and Garanda Samhita as well. We will leave these untouched. I think our little outline of history is pretty well complete, because now we pick it up and look at the way that Sri Aurobindo approaches Hatha Yoga. You'll remember that Sri Aurobindo, while he lived in seeming isolation in Pondicherry, which was his cave of tapasya, he was following out the practice of a yoga, which in a sense was revealed to him step by step, that aimed at perfection from a number of different directions, but the body was not something he left out. He deliberately included the body in the compass of the practice of yoga. If you go to his record of yoga, you'll find many instances where he talks about having taken what we would call asanas to see how long the spirit's command could enjoin upon the body a motionless posture. And he recorded closely how effective each of these practices were. So it wasn't that he sat in a chair in his room. He actually built a stronger physique filled with a much enlarged vital power as he illuminated his consciousness and rained that consciousness down upon these waiting members so that mind became lustrous, life became as vast as the world in him, and his body was seated in peace. His body was a statue, Himalayan. One could not enter the room and not feel that white, auspicious power radiating from his being, as if he were sitting on the crown of the Himalayas, down there in Pondicherry in South India. So let's have a look at this chapter. We'll get a couple of pages into it, and we'll have some more to say about Hatha Yoga and its practices next week. We'll continue. This was simply an outline in history tonight. So chapter 27, Hatha Yoga, published in the Arya on 15 February 1918. There are almost as many ways of arriving at samadhi as there are different paths of yoga. And remember, samadhi in the last chapter was what Sri Aurobindo used as a single term to express what the consciousness experiences when it leaves brute fixity in the physical world and can find its sojourn in inner worlds where it communes with larger principles and powers, and then can finally establish itself in an unmoving identification of subject and object, that there is identity with the only thing that exists, Sat. And this is not an obliteration of consciousness, but a full consciousness, an infinite consciousness. So it is Chit. And what does one experience when one has an infinite consciousness of an infinite being? Bliss, Ananda. Indeed, so great is the importance attached to it, not only as a supreme means of arriving at the highest consciousness, but as the very condition and status of that highest consciousness itself, in which alone it can be completely possessed and enjoyed while we are in the body, that certain disciplines of yoga look as if they were only ways of arriving at samadhi. All yoga is in its nature an attempt and an arriving at unity with the Supreme, unity with the being of the Supreme, unity with the consciousness of the Supreme, unity with the bliss of the Supreme. Or, if we repudiate the idea of absolute unity, at least some kind of union, even if it be only for the soul to live in one status and periphery of being with the divine, salokya, or in a sort of indivisible proximity, samipya, so in the same world or in the same neighborhood. This can only be gained by rising to a higher level and intensity of consciousness than our ordinary mentality possesses. Samadhi, as we have seen, offers itself as the natural status of such a higher level and greater intensity. It assumes naturally a great importance in the yoga of knowledge because there it is the very principle of its method and its object to raise the mental consciousness into a clarity and concentrated power by which it can become entirely aware of, lost in, identified with true being. But there are two great disciplines in which it becomes of an even greater importance to these two systems, to Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga. We may as well now turn. For in spite of the wide difference of their methods from that of the path of knowledge, they have the same principle as their final justification. At the same time, it will not be necessary for us to do more than regard the spirit of their gradations in passing, for in a synthetic and integral yoga, they take a secondary importance. Their aims have indeed to be included, but their methods can either altogether be dispensed with or used only for a preliminary or else a casual assistance. Hatha Yoga is a powerful but difficult and onerous system whose whole principle of action is founded on an intimate connection between the body and the soul. The body is the key. The body, the secret both of bondage and of release, of animal weakness and of divine power, of the obscuration of the mind and soul and of their illumination, of subjection to pain and limitation and of self-mastery, of death and of immortality. The body is not, to the Hatha Yogin, a mere mass of living material, but a mystic bridge between the spiritual and the physical being. One has even seen an ingenious exegete of the Hatha Yogic discipline explain the Vedantic symbol Om as a figure of this mystic human body. But of course, we know that in the practice of Tantra and Hatha Yoga is eventually a development and a popularization of Tantric practices, that the coincidence of divine powers as they descend and enter into the various chakras imposes upon the body the very living presence of the Godhead. So this is really, as he writes, a mystic bridge. One undertakes these disciplines to place that divine consciousness, that particular name, that aspect, to open up, to make flexible, plastic, and clear of obscurity, this aspect, this plane of being at a central point, and then there comes the goddess, there comes the god, and they reside there. First as an experience, and they stay, they withdraw, they come back. And eventually it settles and it becomes real throughout. Now, when all of these chakras are each opened and awakened to their various godheads, then you can see that the body experiences what it is to be eternal, what it is to be conscious all the way into the flesh, into the bone. Although, however, he speaks always of the physical body and makes that the basis of his practices, he does not view it with the eye of the anatomist or physiologist, but describes and explains it in language which always looks back to the subtle body behind the physical system, sukshma sharira. In fact, the whole aim of the Hatha Yogin may be summarized from our point of view, though he would not himself put it in that language, as an attempt by fixed scientific processes to give to the soul in the physical body the power, the light, the purity, the freedom, the ascending scales of spiritual experience, which would naturally be open to it if it dwelt here in the subtle and the developed causal vehicle. So what he's saying is that that which we can achieve in the subliminal planes by awakening to it in the subtler dimensions of the cosmos behind, we can bring something of that into interface with the body, and it too can feel it. To speak of the processes of Hatha Yoga as scientific may seem strange to those who associate the idea of science only with the superficial phenomena of the physical universe, apart from all that is behind them. But they are equally based on definite experience of laws and their workings, and give, when rightly practiced, their well-tested results. There again, the awakened, the realized guru, the teacher, transmitting to the well-prepared seeker, the shishya, the empowering knowledge, what to do. In fact, Hatha Yoga is, in its own way, a system of knowledge. But while the proper yoga of knowledge is a philosophy of being put into spiritual practice, a psychological system, this is the science of being, a psychophysical system. Both produce physical, psychic, and spiritual results, but because they stand at different poles of the same truth, to one, the psychophysical results are of small importance. The pure psychic and spiritual alone matter. And even the pure psychic are only accessories of the spiritual, which absorb all the attention. In the other, the physical is of immense importance, the psychical, a considerable fruit, the spiritual, the highest and consummating result. But it seems for a long time a thing postponed and remote, so great and absorbing is the attention which the body demands. It must not be forgotten, however, that both do arrive at the same end. Hatha Yoga also is a path, though by a long, difficult, and meticulous movement, dukkham optum, to the Supreme. The way of suffering will get you there. Whatever way is appropriate is the path you have to take. This describes the slow elevation of the consciousness as first it gets itself seated, then learns to regulate the breath, then unlocks the bandhas, the locks, and then sees the consciousness ascend, the life force becoming more and more purified, until finally there's the plunging into the samadhi state, which is the goal, finally, of Hatha Yoga as described in the Hatha Pradipika, pardon me, by Swami Swatmarama. All yoga proceeds in its method by three principles of practice. First, purification, that is to say, the removal of all aberrations, disorders, obstructions brought about by the mixed and irregular action of the energy of being on in our physical, moral, and mental system. Secondly, concentration, that is to say, the bringing to its full intensity and the mastered and self-directed employment of that energy of being in us for a definite end. Thirdly, liberation, that is to say, the release of our being from the narrow and painful knots of the individualized energy in a false and limited play, which at present are the law of our nature. So we've seen these, of course, in these very chapters where Sri Aurobindo has described them all. Purity, concentration, samadhi. Along the way, he's described them all. And of course, we've touched upon the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which insists on the yamas and niyamas and the development of the being, and so it goes. They are replicated one in the other. The enjoyment of our liberated being which brings us into unity or union with the Supreme is the consummation. It is that for which yoga is done. Bhukti, which is of course a tantric aim applied here in the field of Hatha Yoga, is one and the same thing. Three indispensable steps, and the high, open, and infinite levels to which they mount. And in all its practice, Hatha Yoga keeps these in view. So Sri Aurobindo has taken pains to describe that Hatha Yoga is part of the general flow. It is not alienated from, it is consanguineous with all the other forms of yoga. Whether we're fixing oneness in the body, whether we're fixing it in the heart in bhakti yoga, whether we're fixing it in the mind in jnana yoga, or all at once in the integral yoga, all strive for identity with the divine. The two main members of its physical discipline, to which the others are mere accessories, are asana, the habituating of the body to certain attitudes of immobility, and pranayama, the regulated direction and arrestation by exercises of breathing of the vital currents of energy in the body. The physical being is the instrument. But the physical being is made up of two elements, the physical and the vital. The body, which is the apparent instrument and the basis, and the life energy, prana, which is the power and the real instrument. Both of these instruments are now our masters. So he's suggesting that we would take up the asana, fix the posture. That is important, and maybe a number to make the body plastic and flexible, but eventually one has to rise to the next level, the more important level of pranayama, and master the breath. Not merely the deep breathing, the placidity that it brings into the nature, but also the kumbhaka, the suspension of it, so that one can live fully in the vital without needing, without depending upon the rising and the falling of the breath. Let's read that sentence again. Both of these instruments are now our masters. We are subject to the body. We are subject to the life energy. It is only in a very limited degree that we can, though souls, though mental beings, at all pose as their masters. Yes. They're constantly telling us about their needs and what their wants are, and we're minions to them. Rarely able to find rationality enough to separate ourselves, to stand back, but usually finding reasons to, in fact, accomplish their goals. We are bound by a poor and limited physical nature. We are bound, consequently, by a poor and limited life power, which is all that the body can bear or to which it can give scope. Moreover, the action of each and both in us is subject not only to the narrowest limitations, but to a constant impurity, which renews itself every time it is rectified into all sorts of disorders, some of which are normal, a violent order, part of our ordinary physical life, others abnormal, its maladies and disturbances. With all this, Hatha Yoga has to deal. All this it has to overcome. and it does it mainly by these two methods: complex and cumbrous in action, but simple in principle and effective. We saw this when we glanced at the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. After first establishing purity, solidity, capacity in the being, we learned to sit. Not in many asanas, but to take a sit in which one became truly still. For one is immobile, ekagrata, at the body level, oneness, one unblinking being. But that, in the life level, is the balancing of the breath, the rising and the falling of the breath. That is pranayama. Yoga Sutras are not so involved in the complexities of pranayama that Hatha Yoga masters through its deep inquiry and practice. It is scientific in that way. And it's when oneness in the breath and oneness in the body are attained that one can fully withdraw from the call of the senses, the call of the emotions, the call of the thoughts, and make the body, the life, and the mind all composed, lined up harmoniously, so that then one can plunge into the deepening experience that leads inevitably to samadhi. The various kinds of samadhi, we have looked at least a glimpse of those. As far as the rest of the system of Hatha Yoga, we'll take up the balance of this chapter next time. And we'll put a bookmark there. Looking for a passage from Savitri which would accord well with this, I found something that you might like in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in Canto 5, The Godheads of the Little Life. And this begins at the bottom of page 169. In this investiture of fleshly life, a soul that is a spark of God survives. And sometimes it breaks through the sordid screen and kindles a fire that makes us half divine. In our body's cells, there sits a hidden power that sees the unseen and plans eternity. Our smallest parts have room for deepest needs. There too the golden messengers can come. A door is cut in the mud wall of self. Across the lowly threshold with bowed heads, angels of ecstasy and self-giving pass, and lodged in an inner sanctuary of dream, the makers of the image of deity live. Pity is there, and fire-winged sacrifice, and flashes of sympathy and tenderness cast heaven lights from the heart's secluded shrine. A work is done in the deep silences, a glory and wonder of spiritual sense, a laughter in beauty's everlasting space, transforming world experience into joy, inhabit the mystery of the untouched gulfs. Lulled by time's beats, eternity sleeps in us. In the sealed hermetic heart, the happy core, unmoved behind this outer shape of death, the eternal entity prepares within its matter of divine felicity, its reign of heavenly phenomenon. even in our skeptic mind of ignorance, a foresight comes of some immense release. Our will lifts towards it slow and shaping hands. Each part in us desires its absolute. Our thoughts covet the everlasting light. Our strength derives from an omnipotent force, and since from a veiled God joy the worlds were made, and since eternal beauty asks for form, even here where all is made of being's dust, our hearts are captured by ensnaring shapes. Our very senses blindly seek for bliss. Our error crucifies reality to force its birth and divine body here, compelling incarnate in a human form and breathing in limbs that one can touch and clasp, its knowledge to rescue an ancient ignorance, its savior light, the inconscient universe. And when that greater self comes sea-like down to fill this image of our transience, all shall be captured by delight, transformed. In waves of undreamed ecstasy shall roll our mind and life and sense, and laugh in a light other than this hard, limited human day. The body's tissues thrill, apotheosized, its cells sustain bright metamorphosis. Namaste, Jai Ma.